This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour, day 93 of the U.S.-Israeli genocide against Palestinians. At least 100 children are killed on average daily. Palestinian resistance fighters kill more invading Israeli soldiers, retaliation for the ongoing onslaught on Gaza. Also coming up, Palestine's Jenin Brigade ambushes Israeli occupation forces, killing at least one Israeli trooper. Thanks for joining us. Israeli strikes on the Gaza Strip continue unabated, leaving behind more casualties every day. The latest Israeli attacks in central Gaza claimed over 40 lives. 11 of those were killed in strikes on a home and a school in a Palestinian refugee camp in the city of Deir al-Balah. Another 20 lost their lives in Israeli raids on the Jabalia refugee camp in the north. That brings to at least 180 the total number of Palestinians killed in Israeli strikes on the coastal sliver over the past 24 hours. Over 22,700 Palestinians have been killed since Israel began its onslaught on Gaza on October 7. The Israeli military campaign against civilians in Gaza has drawn worldwide condemnation, with most countries and international bodies calling for an immediate end to the genocide. The medical charity group Doctors Without Borders says that on average, more than 100 Palestinian children are being killed every day in the Gaza Strip. The group also said kids are dying in every possible way, adding that Israel has killed at least 8,000 children. Meanwhile, the medical group said that it will pull staff and their families out of the areas around Al-Aqsa Hospital after Israeli forces dropped evacuation orders near the facility. The group says artillery fire, sniper fire, and drone attacks have taken place within hundreds of meters of the hospital over the last several days. Added that bullets also penetrated the wall of the ICU in one occasion. The World Health Organization said that Israel has attacked medical infrastructure in Gaza nearly 600 times in the past 3 months. Canadian author and journalist Eric Wahlberg says the U.S. has given Israel a free hand to commit crimes against Palestinians.
Reputable Jews in America are against what's going on. Two of the leading Jewish spokespeople, Jeffrey Sachs, who's a financial expert, he has said that he's pointing his finger at the Old Testament and saying that this massacre going on, it's getting its inspiration from Old Testament massacres that were carried out against the so-called Amalek, the subhuman humans. So there is a real push against this agenda by people like Sachs. And John Mearsheimer has spoken up very strongly in favor of the ICJ case to label this as a genocide and to go after perpetrators. Now, that's an ambitious goal because that would include targeting Biden as well, because he has provided the Israel with its free hand, and it's providing all the arms. So we really are, we have to really point the finger at the U.S.
Palestinian resistance fighters have targeted Israeli forces with heavy shelling after they raided the Al-Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza Strip. The retaliatory attacks were launched by Qassam Brigades, which is the military wing of Hamas resistance movement. One Israeli armored personnel carrier was destroyed by the resistance fighters. Earlier, Qassam also killed 8 Israeli forces in an ambush in Bani Suhaila, east of Khan Yunis. The group says it also destroyed 2 Merkava tanks and a separate operation against Israeli forces in Al-Burej refugee camp. Israel says more than 170 of its troopers have been killed in the Gaza Strip since the regime began its ground invasion of the Palestinian territory on October 27. Resistance groups, however, say the regime is underreporting its casualties. Meanwhile, Israel has launched a new air raid on the West Bank city of Jenin, killing at least 6 Palestinians there. Palestinians say the attack was carried out by a drone. The strike came after an Israeli military vehicle was hit by an explosive device in Jenin. One Israeli soldier was killed and 3 others were injured. The Jenin Brigade Resistance Group has released the footage showing the moments of the explosion. It says the number of the Israeli fatalities is higher than the figure announced by the regime. Israel has stepped up its deadly crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied territory since October the 7th. Since then, hundreds of Palestinians have been killed and over 4,000 others abducted in the occupied West Bank. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, earlier joined us for more details about the Israeli attack on Jenin.
New airstrike has been carried out against a group of Palestinians in an area called the Martyrs Triangle in Jenin. And this airstrike led to the killing of 6 Palestinians. 4 of them are Palestinian brothers, and the 2 more others who had been killed were also the cousins of the 4 brothers who had been killed. We are speaking about 6 Palestinian civilians. Palestinians know that there is an Israeli military of military raid of Jenin and its refugee camp. And we are speaking about an overcrowded area. So people left their homes in order to check what's going on. And then an Israeli airstrike carried out airstrike was carried out against the group of Palestinians.
Group of 30 associations and parties in Kuwait have called on the country's government to join the lawsuit filed by South Africa against Israel at the International Court of Justice. The group issued a statement denouncing international silence toward Israeli crimes in the Gaza Strip. The signatories said the regime's actions constitute war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. South Africa's lawsuit says the magnitude of the death and destruction in the Gaza Strip meets the definition of genocide in international law. Meanwhile, nearly 100 Chilean lawyers have filed a case against the Israeli Prime Minister at the International Criminal Court. The lawsuit calls for an arrest warrant against Benjamin Netanyahu and a number of other Israeli officials for committing crimes against humanity, genocide, and war crimes in Gaza. Vishal Krishnaswamy is a podcaster and journalist who joins us from St. Petersburg. Welcome to the program. So we're seeing this thing obviously gain some momentum, starting with South Africa, really, which was the first country to go after Israel and accuse it of genocide in the ICJ. Now you have the group of Kuwaitis, and then you have the other case, which involves the ICC. Do any of these translate into anything that ultimately will hold Israel accountable and for any prosecution to take place, you think?
With the ICC, absolutely not. Because, for example, there have been many requests for investigations, and the ICC has not sent a single person into the territories of Palestine to investigate any single war crime. On top of that, if we look at the 2023 budget of the ICC, to investigate Palestinian war crimes, the budget is only $944,000, while similarly to investigate alleged Russian war crimes in Ukraine, the budget is $4.3 million. So what it shows us is that the ICC is basically, again, an arm of U.S. and U.K. to kind of do their biting and investigate what they want to investigate. And yes, there have been many calls for a genocide investigation, including the latest group of Chilean lawyers. And they called an investigation with the ICC, but like I said, the budget is not there. They haven't sent a single investigator. In 2019, the ICC ruled that there is enough like preliminary evidence to start an investigation, but the investigation has not happened. Where are the workers being sent to Palestinian? Are they interviewing people? No. Are they looking at footage? A lot of these war crimes are on video. Are they looking at these footages, examining them? None of that is happening. So it seems like the ICC, while there are calls, there is no mechanism with the ICC, nor is there the budget for them to actually go and do this investigation. But hopefully that will change in the near future if there is in the 2024 budget. We'll see.
So it seems like then the only thing that this does is it's in some ways, if there's any image left of Israel on an international level, is to deduct from that image and to take that image to a new low, and to continue keeping the fact that Israel is committing genocidal acts and war crimes inside the Gaza Strip alive. Of course, this U.S.-Israeli genocidal war is continuing, so doesn't need for it to be kept alive. But these things, if they are kept in the news, would make Israel lose more of its international standing, right?
Israel doesn't, everyone knows this, outside of the basically the European Union and the U.S., everyone considers what Israel is doing is genocide, and everyone knows this. Hopefully, it will translate more into trade embargoes on Israel like it happened with South Africa. What people don't remember was that with South Africa, most countries were trading with South Africa. India was the first country to ban trade. And then gradually, within a few decades, every other country would ban trade with South Africa under apartheid. And the U.S. was literally the last country to join the trade sanctions for South Africa. And eventually, South Africa did change a little bit. So I hope that this this low image of Israel will translate into trade embargoes, and I think that is the only way for this to go forward. On top of this, the ICC complaint filed by the Chilean lawyers also noted the silence of many Arab countries who purport to support Palestine, like Oman, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, etc. Hopefully, this will also there will be enough public pressure in these Arab countries so that the leaders do more than just speak and actually translate their speeches into actions.
Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. That's Esha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and journalist there from St. Petersburg. Thank you. Tensions remain high along Lebanon's southern border, where an Israeli airbase has been targeted by Hezbollah resistance movement. Our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, tells us more about the significance of the latest attack and the importance of the base, and also gives us details of the attack itself.
They said that this is the highest peak in all of occupied Palestine, but it is also the only airbase in northern occupied Palestine, Palestine in the northern area. It is on the mountain of Jarmuk, and that mountain is considered, of course, the highest peak. And at the same time, this is an airbase. This is where they control the movements, where there is surveillance, air control. And this is the only headquarters also in the north where you have the Israeli control and monitoring and orchestration of the airstrikes and any air movement that goes towards Lebanon, Cyprus, Turkey, and Iraq, and Syria, of course. This is very significant. So that in itself seems to be another way to avenge the airstrikes that are taking place against Syria itself, since that is where they basically come out from. All of the air strikes that go against Syria, they begin in that base specifically. And now, in addition to the fact that this is a very significant headquarters, if you take a look at the statement of Hezbollah also, they said that this is a preliminary retaliation for the assassination of the Hamas leader, Sheikh Saleh al-Aruri. They did not mention the strike against the southern suburbs of Beirut. They did not mention that this is a retaliation for the Israeli violation of Lebanese sovereignty. And so that perhaps is in itself going to be left for another time.
Yemen has pledged to continue to block the passage of all Israeli-owned and Israeli-bound ships through the Red Sea in response to the regime's genocide in the Gaza Strip.
These developments and the painful developments that are taking place in Palestine led us to take such measures. The Quran has authorized us to defend the oppressed. Every kind of ship linked to the Zionist regime or partially or entirely owned by the regime will not pass through the Red Sea, no matter what the costs, and we will stick with this decision at any cost.
The head of Yemen's Supreme Political Council says the country will not stop its operations until Israel ends its onslaught and siege on the Gaza Strip. Mahdi al-Mashat says this is meant for peace. Mashat also says Yemenis are committed to protecting their brothers in Gaza and are ready for all possibilities. He warned that all options are available to the Yemeni army. His comments come after the U.S. warned Yemen of consequences if it does not stop the attacks. The Yemeni armed forces have launched missile and drone attacks on vessels operated by Israel or heading to its ports in solidarity with Gazans for several weeks. Thousands of Israelis have once again rallied in Tel Aviv to protest against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over his failure to secure the release of captives in Gaza. Protesters were angry at Netanyahu's handling of captives' release. They demanded his immediate resignation and called for early elections. The demonstrators vowed to continue their protest until all captives were released. Netanyahu has been in hot water over his handling of the Gaza war. Israel has so far failed to release any of the captives by military means. It has also failed to achieve any of its stated goals of the war. Israel has been the scene of anti-Netanyahu rallies for months. The Israeli prime minister has been charged with fraud, bribery, and the breach of trust in three cases filed in 2019. Protesters have taken to the streets of the French capital, Paris, to call for an end to the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war against the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Free, free Palestine! Free, free Palestine! Free, free Palestine! Free, free Palestine!
Protesters waved Palestinian flags and chanted slogans as they marched through the streets of Paris. They called on Israeli authorities to withdraw their forces from Gaza and allow for the humanitarian aid to go into the blockaded territory. The demonstrators also call for an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. Protesters have turned out in their masses across the globe for the past several weeks to show solidarity with the Palestinians. They have been demanding an immediate end to the Israeli massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. They've also called on Western countries to stop their financial and military support for the Israeli regime. Iran's foreign minister tells his French counterpart that the U.S. and Israel are responsible for the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark in a phone call with Catherine Colonna. The Iranian minister said the root causes of instability in the region are Israel's occupation and giving the regime a free hand to commit massacres against civilians. Amir Abdollahian told Colonna that one cannot ignore this and at the same time be worried about the security in the Red Sea and the wider region. He said the cessation of Israeli crimes and genocidal attacks and the facilitation of sending humanitarian aid to Gaza are among effective steps towards ending violence in the region. And that is it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Welcome back to Aperture. Before we follow Javad, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the desert regions in South Khorasan province, an area of vast desert, sand dunes, and aridness as far as the eye can see. But amid what looks like arid wasteland, at first are wonderful and amazing surprises, including canyons, freshwater springs, and traces of past civilizations. But perhaps what is even more amazing, the next part of the program, is that this dry, arid land yields the world's most coveted spice and Iran's prized red gold, saffron.
I leave behind the ruins of Dihuk and its beautiful architecture for my main destination, which is the terraced saffron farms of Esfandiar, a patchwork of little farms that demands the attention of any visitor. The name Esfandiar was derived from the word espand, or wild rue plants that grow in abundance in and around this village. In the spring season, perennial plants make the mountains surrounding Esfandiar all the more beautiful. In my opinion, this village is a masterpiece, home to many and varied beauties in and around it. The people of Esfandiar are kind, faithful, and hardworking. Farming is the main occupation of the people living in this part of the country, and their main produce is Iran's famed red gold, that is, saffron. The fragrant, vivid crimson threads are known by almost everybody around the world, and has forever been the world's most expensive spice. In the words of researchers, the history of saffron goes back thousands of years. Iran was the first place where these beautiful flowers were planted. And after Iran's neighboring countries such as India, Syria, and Lebanon found out about it, it was also planted in Greece for the first time. The word zafaran is the Arabicized version of the word zarparan, meaning a flower with petals of gold. Saffron threads are plucked from the flower saffron crocus and used mainly as a seasoning and coloring agent in food. Historically, saffron has been among the most expensive spices in the world. Harvesting saffron is so labor-intensive. every 150,000 crocus flowers that weigh approximately 75 kilos yields a meager 1 kilo of this sought-after spice. The crocus bulb grows multiple flowers for several years, but after that, the number of its buds decreases by the year. Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Isfandiyar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens. The lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies, the vast terraced saffron farms, and the very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Isfandiyar that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. Beauties have turned Isfandiyar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a school teacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Isfandiyar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Isfandiyar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads.
Oh,
It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning, and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold, and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Esfandiar are master pickers, hands down. If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God, even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people too hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hard-working people go through. I can feel their pain, but there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the back-breaking harvesting process, but it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems. But Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this tea, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day from morning till evening doing backbreaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Isfandiyar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, the quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Isfandiyar, I see many tourists here. There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Isfandiyar's. But unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, they can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible If the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. The beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air, beautiful, vacant yet livable villages, the farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
Well, perhaps next time you'll enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Isfandiar and the kind and hard-working farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the firstest of brothers not the last one
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Kitabullah. This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم dear listeners, welcome back to IRB English Radio. This is the program for a better life and I am Bita, and once again I have the chance and opportunity to be at your service. We're going to talk more about the methods and ways of being grateful. And as I told you, being grateful has many benefits both in this life and afterlife and the resurrection day. The question that comes up is that, can gratefulness be realized just by saying praise be to Allah before all these material blessings? Think of our organs, the eyes, the ears, the tongue, the hands, the legs, the heart, veins, nerves, and bones. Consider other material blessings like food, drink, beautiful scenes of nature like mountains, plains, woods, rivers, springs, seas, and have the different fruits, grains, vegetables, and millions of other blessings that are considered as tools and means that keep the life and the survival of man. So, can man offer the real gratefulness to Allah just by saying thanks be to Allah in return for the blessings of Islam, faith, guidance, guardianship, knowledge, wisdom, health, safety, purification, satisfaction, obedience, love, worship, and the likes? You know, I think it takes hours and hours, like millions of hours, to count all these blessings. So, I think one of the interesting ways, specifically for young ages, like children, to make them understand how huge are the blessings that Allah Almighty gave us, is, for example, to make them write all the blessings that come to their mind. And it's a really beautiful way, because you may, for example, fill a 100-page book by the blessings that comes to your mind, and it's not going to end. And, you know, it will touch your heart to some extent that you're nothing compared to all the blessings that are around you. And being gratefulness is, you know, is really necessary. Sometimes we forget the vastness of all the blessings that we have in our life. One of the ulama says in his book that the origin of thanking is from Ain Shukra. It means from an eye full of tears or a spring full of pure water. Beautiful. Therefore, the meaning of gratefulness is that the ears of man become full of the mention of Allah and that he pays full attention to the blessings of Allah, how he gets them and how he uses them. So let's keep it here. We're going to go for a short break. Wait for more beautiful guidance in order to have a better life.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. All I need.
Your love is all I need. To be all I need. And I know that you see how much you need. You mean to me, 'cause your love is all I need. To be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Your love is all I need.
Welcome back. This is IRB English Radio, listening to the program for a better life. And we were talking about the origin of thanking itself, which was Ain Shukra, which the meaning of this word, if I'm not mistaken in pronunciation, because I'm not really good at Arabic, was actually an eye full of tears. And another actually scientist and known as the teacher of the human beings in the 11th mind, which is actually Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi, says about the fact of gratefulness, as mentioned by Allama Majlisi. Gratefulness is the best and most exalted of deeds. You should know that gratefulness is actually meeting blessings with saying, doing, and intention all together. Gratefulness depends on three bases. The first is knowing the benefactor and his suitable aspects and appreciating blessings and acknowledging that all the blessings, whether apparent or hidden, are from Allah the Almighty. So you have to understand that all the means between man and these blessings and talents are determined by the will of Allah Almighty. The second base is the coming true of the state. The state here means being submissive and humble before the benefactor and being happy and delighted with blessings. We should know that all the blessings are gifts from Allah the Almighty to His servants and as evidence of the care of Allah towards His servants. The sign of the coming true of the state is that we shouldn't be delighted with material blessings except in a way that brings us nearer to Allah. And the third base of gratefulness is doing. Doing should appear in three stages: the heart, the tongue, and the organs. So the doing of the heart is glorifying Allah, praising Him, pondering in His creatures, doings, and mercy, and having determination to give goodness to all of the creatures. As for the doing of the tongue, it is accomplished by showing words of thankfulness, praise, glorifying Allah, enjoining people to do good, and forbidding them from doing bad. And the doing of the organs is using them to worship Allah and obey Him and keeping them away from disobeying Him. Hence, the real meaning of gratefulness shows that gratefulness is one of the aspects of perfection. It is so little that gratefulness appears in a full way by the people who have enjoyed the blessings, as the Holy Quran says, and very few of my servants are grateful. Gratefulness for the blessings, according to the previous meaning, is a reasonable and legal obligation. Gratefulness for blessings become real by using these blessings in a way Allah has determined. In fact, worship and complete servitude to Allah is achieved by real gratefulness for the blessings. Allah says, "Therefore, eat of what Allah has given you, lawful and good things, and give thanks for Allah's favor if Him do serve." And another verse of Holy Quran, "Therefore seek the sustenance from Allah and serve Him and be grateful to Him. To Him you shall be brought back." So being grateful for blessings is achieved by refraining from sins. Full gratefulness is to say, "Praise be to Allah, the Lord of the worlds." Being grateful for blessings is by using them in worshipping, being obedient, helping people, doing good to them, and by refraining from all sins and bad doings. So, as we talked up to here, I'm going to give you the gist of the episode of today, which was really important. And today, scientists are actually working on the benefits of being grateful. And in this episode, we actually fully talked about the meaning of being grateful from the Islamic point of view and combined with some verses from Holy Quran, which it has three stages that you have to be grateful by your heart, by your tongue, and by your organs, and you have to do good things, and you have to use all the blessings in the way that Allah Almighty determined you to do. And thank you, dear listeners. I think it was all the time for today's episode. I wish you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.